In New Zealand, a plan to rework the country's foundational treaty with the Maori indigenous people has sparked a historic response. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll hear about the political shift in New Zealand and how China is looking at the next U.S. administration under Donald Trump.
Beijing wants a cooperative, constructive, and practical relationship with the United States. Simply too much is at stake.
Also, why Israel's prime minister is facing questions about leaked documents and how the war in Ukraine is creating divisions among Orthodox Christians in Moldova.
How could a church bless a war that is against our brothers, against our Orthodox believers?
All that and more today on The World. Thank you for joining us today.
We begin the program in New Zealand, where tens of thousands of people marched to the capital in defense of indigenous Maori rights. It's being described as the biggest protest in the country in generations.
The issue that sparked it all is a proposed law that would radically change how New Zealand's founding treaty should be interpreted. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains why thousands of people have taken to the streets to object.
They walked for 9 days from the north, crossing more than 600 miles. They reached New Zealand's parliament on Tuesday. In Wellington, the crowd swelled to 42,000 people. It was perhaps the biggest protest in New Zealand's history. TV One News spoke to protesters.
Our people are getting stronger and stronger, and we're finally standing up for what is ours, what we deserve.
We have a coalition government who are really in some ways seeking to almost re-assimilate Māori back into New Zealand society. It's a risk not only for Māori, but for all New Zealanders.
The march is a response to the so-called Treaty Principles Bill. It's the baby of the far-right party known as ACT, a minor party, but one that holds sway since the last elections. The controversial bill is essentially the party making good on a campaign promise. The bill would fundamentally restrict Maori rights guaranteed in the country's founding document, the Treaty of Waitangi. That's the 1840 contract between the British Crown and the Maori chiefs. The problem is there are two versions of the treaty, a version in English and a version in Maori, and the two versions are not the same. It's been up to the courts to reconcile the two, so they've come up with a set of so-called treaty principles that have been used over the years to guarantee Maori rights from land ownership to reparations. The ACT Party wants to rewrite the treaty principles. David Seymour, the head of ACT and Associate Minister for Justice, defended his bill in the House late last week.
The bill does not extinguish any right. It does not take from anyone. It reinforces the rights of the treaty as universal.
Seymour said the treaty principles, as they're understood and applied right now, do not work.
What all of these principles have in common is that they afford Māori different rights from other New Zealanders.
The bill probably won't pass. It doesn't have enough support, but that's not the point, says Richard Shaw. He's a political scientist at Massey University in Auckland.
The legislation will create further division. There'll be more noise. There'll be more attempts to divide people. It will be not constructive.
Now that the bill has been introduced, it goes to a select committee, a process which takes 6 months. That's enough time, says Shaw, for organizations that are hostile to redressing colonial wrongs to mobilize and spread misinformation.
They will flood social media and the mainstream media and the airwaves and the digital waves with arguments that mask and invisibilize the ways in which Māori have historically not been treated equally, and it has almost always been to their disadvantage.
But here's another historical truth, he says. Maori do not take discrimination lying down. They have a long tradition of fighting for their rights, a tradition that was very much on display on Tuesday.
And we got a message to this government. Kill the bill! Kill the bill! Kill the bill!
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Turning our attention to Israel, It has been called a security investigation, and it's rattling the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The investigation has several strands. Numerous people in the PM's office are suspected of mishandling classified intelligence documents, and Netanyahu's own chief of staff is accused of falsifying government transcripts from the early days of the war in Gaza in order to make things look better for his boss. The alleged misconduct has been made public just as Netanyahu is set to testify in his own corruption trial that reaches back to 2019. Noga Tarnopolsky is an Israeli reporter based in Jerusalem. We spoke earlier today, and I asked her what all the strands of this investigation have in common.
The one thing that connects them all, unfortunately for the prime minister, is he himself. All of these people, however highly placed or lowly placed in the various offices of the government military complex in Israel, they're all connected to him.
So at the center of this are some extremely sensitive military documents. So what are they about?
We're talking about kind of the holy of the holies in Israeli military intelligence. We're talking about documents gathered using secret intel methods by the IDF intelligence branch. And these documents were never intended to be seen by anyone. Somehow, some of them appeared in two foreign media, one in Great Britain and one in Germany. And this was the first indication for the Israeli military that maybe they had a mole. It's taken about 2 months to find out that what appears to have happened is that those documents were copied or taken without permission and somehow made their way via a number of intel officers to the office of the Prime Minister of Israel, where instead of getting turned over to the Shin Bet, as they should have been.
Shin Bet, that's the Israeli intelligence agency, correct?
Yes. They were tampered with. And after being tampered with so as to advance political lines that the prime minister wanted to advance at that time, we're talking about September, they were then implanted in two friendly foreign media outlets.
So start with what makes these documents sensitive in the first place, and how did the tampering change their intent, if you will?
It's important to say most of this story is still under a military gag order, and I can only tell you what I know. But there are two instances, and Netanyahu used these foreign publications to go public with information. It was tampered with to adhere to notions that he wanted to advance at the time. For example, that Israel could never leave the Gaza Strip. That was one. And the other one, that Hamas's head at the time, Yahya Sinwar, who has since been killed, was planning to take hostages with him through tunnels into Egypt and from there possibly to Iran. So these were two statements that were aimed at persuading the Israeli public that it would be dangerous for them, because if Yahya Sinwar escaped, he would continue to threaten them from abroad, and possibly to the hostages if the Israeli army or the Israeli government made any kind of a deal, a hostage release deal. It was part of Netanyahu's attempt to influence Israeli public opinion to believe that only ongoing war could help free these hostages.
So Israel is in the midst of war, raging on several fronts. Countries often pull together during wartime. What does this scandal mean for the stability of Netanyahu's government and its longevity?
Well, Netanyahu's government appears to be holding strong. It has survived now for 14 months since the worst security catastrophe in the country's history. But what we're seeing is that the war and these associated scandals, these latest scandals really verge on accusations of treason in wartime. We're talking about intel officers surreptitiously stealing top secret documents that reveal sources and methods. And these documents, in a transmogrified way, end up appearing in foreign media, implanted in foreign media, which the prime minister then uses to try and sway public opinion towards him. So one of the things this is telling us is that Israeli public opinion is not being swayed towards him, and he has been willing to go to extraordinary lengths, he or his people. He is not yet directly considered a suspect or directly implicated in these scandals, but as several colleagues of mine pointed out today, it's becoming a situation in which it appears the entire prime minister's office, except for the prime minister, knew that these shenanigans were going on.
Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky is based in Jerusalem. She's been speaking with us about a scandal involving secret documents in Israel.
For decades, men's tennis has been dominated by the big three. That's Roger Federer, Novak Djokovic, and Rafael Nadal. Federer bid farewell in 2022. Now it's Nadal's turn.
Hola a todos. Estoy aquí para comunicaros que me retiro del tenis profesional.
The Spaniard announced his retirement in a social media video last month. Today, he stepped onto the court for his final tournament as a pro. The world's Bianca Hillier reports on his legacy.
Born in Mallorca, Nadal first got his hands on a tennis racket at age 4. By 7, he was training hard. And at just 15, he turned pro.
That is fantastic. Well played, Rafael Nadal.
Reporter Christopher Clary first met the teenager a couple of years later.
17-year-old Nadal was much shyer, had trouble looking you in the eye a little bit. You know, his natural modesty was there, and also he was kind of just big eyes, looking at everything, sort of taking it all in.
Clary has covered Nadal ever since. Over the years, the tennis star's shyness has faded. Still, his ego remains in check.
In a world of, honestly, a lot of spoiled superstars in sports, Nadal is pretty down to earth. When the point is done and the match is over, he treats people with respect and, you know, remembers to say hello and shake the hands. That shouldn't be as rare as it is, but it is a bit rare at that high level of sport.
And he certainly has hit the highest level of tennis.
Another champion for Spain, and this time it's a teenager.
It's the miracle.
According to the Association of Tennis Professionals, Nadal has earned more than $130 million in prize money alone. He's won 22 Grand Slams, including 14 French Opens.
It's another outrageous run for Rafa at Roland Garros.
14 French Opens is, in the words of many players, insane.
Clary predicts that of all of Nadal's impressive stats, that one will prove the most enduring. It shows talent, he adds, but also focus and humility.
Being able to start fresh every year with this challenge that you've already achieved and have the desire to make it happen.
Nadal will also be remembered by a nickname, the King of Clay. He's won around 90% of all his matches on the surface. But this week, he's ending his professional career on hard courts at the Davis Cup in Malaga, Spain.
Rafa Nadal!
Tears welled up in Nadal's eyes as the home crowd welcomed him to the court and Spain's national anthem played. He went on to perform well, but it wasn't enough, and Nadal lost the match today. It has been a couple of years since he won a major tournament. The 38-year-old acknowledged in a press conference this week that, physically, it's been a tough final few years.
No hay despedida ideal. Los finales de película normalmente son para películas americanas.
There is no ideal farewell, he said. Movie-like endings are usually for American movies, but I realized a long time ago that I wouldn't have one of those. Nadal's impact on tennis is nowhere near over. In retirement, he's expected to stick around the sport, including in his hometown of Manacor, where the Rafa Nadal Tennis Academy trains the next generation of greats. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Leaders of the 20 biggest economies are meeting in Brazil, and the political goals of the G20 nations don't always line up. Just ahead, what China hopes to get from the summit in Rio. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Shirin Jafari, a reporter for The World, where I cover the Middle East. As you know, we've been following the Israel-Hamas war closely, even as it was just beginning to develop. In March, I traveled on board a Jordanian aid plane to understand the challenges in delivering essential supplies to Gaza. I wanted to give our listeners an inside look at the risks and dedication involved in getting even small amounts of aid to the people of Gaza. More recently, I shared the powerful story of photographer Rania Matar. Matar's iconic photo, Barbie Girl, captured destruction and rebirth in Beirut following the 2006 Israeli invasion. This October, as Lebanon braced for another invasion from Israel, Matar connected with her photo's subject, now 19-year-old Lynn Abbas. Their reunion brought a glimmer of hope amidst the violence, a reminder that Beirut might rebuild again, despite uncertainty. Stories like these may only last minutes on air, but the work behind them takes months, even years, of building relationships and establishing sources. Reporting on these events is essential, and it requires your support. The World is an independent, non-profit newsroom. We're not funded by billionaires. Instead, we rely on listeners like you. As we approach the end of year, we're aiming to raise $67,000, and we're counting on your help. A generous donor has pledged to match every gift dollar for dollar. So if you give $25, it turns into $50 for the newsroom. If you give $250, that becomes $500. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. I really can't emphasize how much your support means to our newsroom. Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A new Cold War should not be fought and cannot be won. That's a quote from the Chinese government readout following a meeting on Saturday between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden. The two leaders talked for 2 hours on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Conference Summit in Lima, Peru. Afterward, President Biden said, "Our two countries cannot let any of this competition veer into conflict." This was likely to be the last face-to-face meeting between Biden and Xi before Donald Trump takes office in January. For some perspective on what's at stake for Beijing in the U.S.-China relationship, we're speaking with Juan Guang. He's with China's state television network CGTN, and he's in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, this week to cover the G20 summit, which both Biden and Xi are attending. Guan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Carolyn, great to be with you.
When they met on Saturday, both Joe Biden and Xi Jinping stressed the importance of communication. Biden talked about it preventing competition from turning into conflict. Is the Chinese leadership worried about where things are heading with Donald Trump returning to the White House?
China made it very clear. I think Beijing thinks that whomever is to be the next U.S. president, Beijing wants a cooperative, constructive, and practical a relationship with the United States. Simply too much is at stake. We have $600 billion, $700 billion of trading relations. Millions of Chinese living in the United States and hundreds of thousands studying there as students. And we're two big countries that have nuclear weapons. So I think we need a new paradigm for China-U.S. relations going forward that should be marked by being inclusive, being pragmatic, thinking more liberally and more open-mindedly towards each other.
So I want to talk now about Ukraine. G20 leaders last night issued a joint statement that calls for an end to the war in Ukraine, but it did not condemn Russia's invasion. China has been supporting Russia throughout the war. What do you think the Chinese government is hoping to see happen in Ukraine as this war continues?
China made it very clear that we don't want war. We don't want suffering. We don't want killing of any kind, be it in Gaza, in Yemen, or in Ukraine, or in Russia. I don't think China is supporting Russia's operations against Ukraine.
China has voted against condemning Russia at the UN multiple times or abstained from that vote. China has been buying oil and gas from Russia when many other countries have not done that. The National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, says that China is selling Russia technology that helps their military manufacturing. So, to what end? What is China hoping happens with Russia in Ukraine?
In 2014, when there has been this operation against Crimea, but up to this day, the Chinese government do not readily recognize the so-called incorporation of Crimea to Russia. There's a fine line here. I mean, people don't understand the nuances sometimes. Don't forget, China is not a party to this fight. It is unfortunate, and China wants to work with all parties to resolve this issue.
I don't think you've quite answered the question, though. The Chinese government is providing support in many ways to Russia. Russia invaded Ukraine. What does China hope to see happen with Ukraine?
China provided humanitarian goods, relief goods to Ukraine. I don't know about the specific items that you're referring to, but what I'm saying is that China has made multiple attempts within the UN and with our global partners to call on all parties to stop the war. I mean, when the U.S. provides weaponry and warplanes and F-16 jets to Ukraine, I don't think that's helpful. That's adding fuel to the fire as well.
However, that is, helping a nation protect its sovereign borders, whereas Russia was the invader in this case.
Well, don't forget, when NATO expanded some five times since the 1990s and expanded all the way to Russia's borders, what about that? Did the mainstream media even talk about that? Or did the military-industrial complex, ever reflect on its worth or its merit? I mean, I think some people in Washington needed an enemy so that they can keep producing and selling their weapons. And I think wars and sufferings are bad. So it is in Gaza. I don't think the U.S. should support Israel when it comes to the tens of thousands of women and children being killed. And I don't think China has been supporting any war, be it Russia's operations in Ukraine either.
All right. I want to move on to a different topic. The Philippines, it's a U.S. ally, and the government there is frustrated by how the Chinese military has been operating in the region. Here's something Gilberto Teodoro said recently. He's the Philippines' defense secretary.
What we see is an increasing demand by Beijing for us to concede our sovereign rights in the area because of our need to explore and exploit the resources in these areas for the benefit of our own people. And that is clear.
He went on to say that, quote, we are direct victims of Chinese aggression. Where do you think this situation is headed in the South China Sea?
I think that it's up to the Chinese and the Philippines. The soundbite that you just played me, I think, is, of course, arguing from the point of view of the Philippines. But China claims that it has historical rights when it comes to the territories and the maritime borders of South China Sea. I think U.S. should leave this issue of South China Sea to the parties directly involved, that is Manila and Beijing, instead of interfering and siding with one side. This will only make matters worse.
Though the U.S. does have a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines, so there is an obligation there.
Well, I understand, but unfortunately, I think some of these conventions need to be reconfigured. If you have a defense treaty with Israel, that doesn't mean that you can tolerate the killing of tens of thousands of children in Gaza.
One more topic I want to talk with you about, climate change. Action on climate change is a major point of discussion at the G20 summit right now, as you have mentioned. Trump has said that he will encourage oil drilling and fracking and pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement once again. In the absence of U.S. leadership on climate change, will China take on more of that role internationally?
I think China has, and China has indeed been doing that. If you look at electric vehicles, for example, some 65 to 66% of the world's new electric vehicles roll off manufacturing plants in China. The lithium batteries, an important part of electric vehicles, China produces more of that than the rest of the world combined. Yes, China wants to be a leader in this fight. I mean, we're all in this together. If you're a mother in Shanghai or a father in Boston, we want the same things for our children, clear waters and clean forests and sustainable ecosystems.
Juan Guan is a commentator with CGTN, China's government-run English-language news channel. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Carolyn, thank you so much.
Staying with China, 45 high-profile activists and lawmakers in Hong Kong were sentenced today, some of them getting up to 10 years in prison. Their crime was an attempt to hold an unofficial primary election to pick opposition candidates. Amelia Wong, whose boyfriend was sentenced, says the punishment is intended to discourage the pro-democracy movement.
You see how a primary can be illegal and lead to 10 years of sentencing. So, of course, it will silence more people.
The trial and sentences sparked criticism from foreign governments and rights groups. They blasted China for criminalizing political dissent under a national security law imposed by Beijing in 2021. Beijing, however, defends the court's decisions. Chris Tang is Hong Kong's Secretary for Security.
I think different people may have different judgment about whether sentencing is appropriate.
But I think the important point is the rule of law.
Other Chinese officials say no one should be allowed to use democracy as an excuse for being unlawful. You're listening to The World.
They wrote some of the most enduring stories in the Western world, and we're still learning more about the Brothers Grimm.
They actually intensified some of the violence in the tales, and they did that to teach a moral lesson.
How the writers sourced those stories and what they hoped they would do for German society once published. That is ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global carbon emissions are on track to hit a record high this year. That will continue to heat the planet, wreak havoc on ecosystems, and fuel more extreme natural disasters. How to pay for coping with these impacts and for switching to renewable energy, it's the biggest issue delegates at the annual UN Climate Summit are tackling right now. That's in Baku, Azerbaijan. The World's Jury Buscarin reports.
Sandeep Chamlingrai would love to replant mangrove swamps along the coast of the Southwest Indian Ocean to help manage storm surges or work on sustainable fishing practices.
Or, in a worst-case scenario, we need to have a plan B of relocating certain communities.
As a global lead for the World Wildlife Fund, Rai has a $15 million proposal to do a risk assessment in countries like Kenya and Madagascar, and then put in climate programs, which his organization has already piloted in other places. What he doesn't have is the funding.
And we don't have a luxury of time, so we need to really act now. But getting money from this multilateral is time-consuming. They have their own procedures and all that, so it's a bit complicated.
There are two things at stake at COP29. How much countries will collectively agree to spend on climate projects, and how that money will be doled out. Should it be in grants or a mix of investments and loans?
We are now at this stage beyond adaptation.
Leanne Shalatek directs climate finance work for the Henrik Boll Foundation, a think tank affiliated with Germany's Green Party. This year, the globe will likely surpass the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming limit that countries agreed to aim for in 2015. Shalatek says this money will have to help pay for losses and damages created by climate disasters, too.
Simple resilience measures are already no longer enough, and you have really economic and non-economic impacts that are beyond what you can adapt to.
This year's new financing goal will replace the $100 billion goal established in 2009. Proposals under consideration range from $200 billion to a $1.3 trillion annual commitment requested by lower-income countries.
Everybody knows that it has to be a much, much larger amount to actually account for the realities of not only the urgent climate action that we need, transition energy systems and economies, but particularly also to deal with the devastating climate impacts that we are already seeing around the world.
The money could fund prevention measures like seawalls, Shalatek says, but it could also pay for losses and damage. But there are already problems with how current spending commitments are being allocated.
The mood is quite downbeat. My sense is that the negotiations still have a long way to go.
Patrick Hedgel-Wright is a campaigner for Recourse, an organization tracking climate finance. Because countries have been reporting climate project funding to the UN for several years now, it's possible to get an idea of what they're actually spending it on. And Wright says a lot of the projects they're funding have little to do with the environment. They seem to be things governments were planning to invest in anyways.
Climate finance is being used as a label for basically continuing business as usual.
Like an airport expansion in southern Turkey, a waste incineration project in the Maldives, a liquefied natural gas plant in Mozambique. Some projects, Wright says, get climate funding even though they are actively increasing carbon emissions. But she doesn't think this is a reason to abandon climate finance entirely.
The goals that we've had so far aren't adequate. They need to be higher, and countries need to step up. But we also need to look at what climate finance is, and we need to sharpen the definition for what can and can't count as climate finance.
In press conferences organized on the sidelines at COP, activists have made the case for funding beyond the $1.3 trillion benchmark, all the way up to $5 trillion.
This is not aid for the global south or for the developing countries. This is reparations for what we are owed.
Liddy Nakpil is a human rights activist from the Philippines, and she speaks to a theme you hear often. Emerging economies are among the countries most vulnerable to climate change, and they're often the ones with the fewest per capita carbon emissions. They did not make this mess, and they want rich countries to clean it up.
This is not just for the sake of our people. Climate finance is very key to the success of stopping climate change. So this climate finance is for the sake of the whole of humanity and the whole of the planet.
COP negotiations are scheduled to continue for the rest of the week, although they often go longer. For the world, I'm Jerry Buscarin.
Mali in West Africa is one of the biggest gold producers on the continent. That makes it very attractive to multinational mining companies. But an Australian corporation called Resolute Mining is having an especially difficult time there right now. The company's CEO and two other executives were detained by Mali's military government for 10 days after a tax dispute. On Monday, Resolute Mining said it agreed to pay $160 million to get them out. Beverly Ocheng is with the Africa program at the Center for International Strategic Studies. She's in neighboring Senegal. What did this Australian mining company just agree to do, Beverly?
Well, yeah, so Resolute Mining has said that it's going to be paying the Malian government a total of $160 million. The first $80 million, it said in its statement, will come from some of its revenues. And then another amount, the remaining half, is going to be sent in the coming months. And this is because since about the 8th of November, the authorities in Mali have detained the CEO who had been there. There have been long-running negotiations with mining sector stakeholders on new regulations that came into effect in 2023. So he seemed to have been caught up in this. And this happened before, even in September. And it's been a long-running process with various mining sector stakeholders to help them transition towards the new regulations.
So these executives were meeting, I read, with officials in the Malian capital, Bamako, over the issue of taxes, and then they were detained. What is the background to this tax dispute? I mean, where did it come from? And is it related to those new regulations you mentioned?
Well, so Mali introduced some new regulations in August 2023. They passed what they call a mining code, which then governs how the sector is run. One of the key changes was that Mali would increase its stake in the sector from 20 to 35%. There'd be changes to royalties from mining companies, and they would ensure that local stakeholders are involved in most of the production process. Now, these agreements tend to take place after the fact. And in this case, Mali is trying to implement them retroactively, given that current operators are being asked to move on to this mining code, despite there being clauses that would keep them from immediately transitioning from this. Now, what happened afterwards is in November last year, Mali issued a moratorium on any new permits, and they started doing an audit of the mining sector. So various companies were asked to submit documentation afresh. They were asked to send in tax registration documents. And so a variety of disputes have arisen from this, of which Resolute is just one example.
I mean, we should remember that the military government in Mali took power in a coup in 2021. The current leader, Colonel Assimi Goïta, kicked out France's longtime presence there and has welcomed Russian troops. How has the country reconfigured its political and trade relationships with international partners since these big changes?
The 2021 coup is the one that shifted things remarkably because he essentially, Assimi Goïta, took power, became the president. They then started making overtures or receiving overtures from Russia. They then moved away from a lot of Western diplomatic and security presence. UN peacekeepers ended up leaving late last year, and the drawdown of the forces and the operations of the UN were concluded earlier this week. There has been an increase in Russian presence, economic, diplomatic, and security. They have influenced the reconfiguration of neighboring countries like Burkina Faso and Niger, which are now more willing to cooperate with Russia. It has meant that the environment is more challenging for Western commercial operators as well as Western diplomatic relations. There have been acrimonious exchanges with Denmark, which then withdrew its forces and developmental aid. Same with Sweden over its own stance on the Ukraine conflict, which is contrary to the pro-Russian stance.
Beverly, for the government in Mali, though, to detain three employees from Resolute Mining, including its CEO, and a similar move, as you mentioned, with another company in September, should such a move surprise us?
It has come as a bit of a surprise. Of course, the negotiations on this mining code have been quite tense, and there have been some instances of selective application or case-by-case application, but it is definitely an escalation of those negotiations. And of course, it just means that the regulatory environment is going to be much more uncertain in the coming years, and there will not be much clarity on what issues the Malian government is likely to raise. So in one instance, it was a tax dispute. In another instance, it was environmental practices against a company. In another one, a mine was expropriated after a long-running dispute with both a South African and a Canadian company. And all of these are different sets of circumstances, but ultimately they feed into the idea that the Malian military government will want more control over the sector, economic concessions. They will want to streamline the adoption of the mining code, and various measures are likely to be applied to ensure that stakeholders adhere to their demands.
Beverly Ochiang is a senior associate with the Center for International and Strategic Studies. She joined us from Dakar, the Senegalese capital.
The thing about fairy tales is they never get old, like Hansel and Gretel, two children wandering in the forest, tempted into a witch's house made of candy, until Gretel pushes the witch into an oven.
This is hot enough for you now!
My sister and I never saw our parents again. But we learned a couple of things while trapped in that house. Never walk into a house made of candy.
That's from the 2013 remake Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters. It's a story we might never have heard if it weren't for the Brothers Grimm back in the 1800s. Anne Schmiesing has written a new biography of the Brothers Grimm that details how their fairy tales were part of a larger effort to form a German national identity. And the brothers lived before Germany had been united into one country. I gather they grew up in Hessen. Can you tell me a little bit about their upbringing?
Their father was appointed a district magistrate in a mountain town called Steinau. It had about 1,400 or so inhabitants at the time the Grimms moved there. So they grew up in this pretty idyllic setting. Their father, however, died in his 40s. They were just around 10 and 11. So their childhood changes dramatically with the death of their father. So their fortunes change a lot, and they rely on the generosity of one of their aunts and also their grandfather in the years immediately after.
How did the Brothers Grimm go about collecting the fairy tales that they would eventually publish?
There are a lot of myths actually already widespread in the 19th century that the Grimms went door to door or out in the fields, into spinning parlors, collecting tales directly from the mouths of peasants. But by and large, they are collecting so many of their fairy tales from literate townspeople, particularly middle class, even upper class young women, also some from printed sources. When they do find a woman who kind of corresponds with their notion of an ideal storyteller, her name was Dorothea Fiemann. She was in her 50s, daughter of an innkeeper and wife of a tailor. They collected around 40 tales from her, and she's the one, the only one, that they named by name in the preface to their collection, and they actually had a frontispiece depicting her in their edition of tales. So she kind of corresponded more with their ideal image of a fairy tale storyteller, but most of their tales do not come from sources such as that. And then they're collecting tales. They often are merging two or more tellings of the same tale into what they view as an ideal version. And they make significant edits as they are revising their tales from edition to edition. And that's primarily Wilhelm Grimm who is making those edits.
So I'm curious, you know, I think the one thing that most people know about the Brothers Grimm is that their version of fairy tales are often darker than other versions. Does this kind of search for authenticity and wanting to portray fairy tales as they're told out in the countryside, does that explain that sharp edge?
One of the things that they did is that they actually intensified some of the violence in the tales. And they did that to teach a moral lesson.
Huh.
So if you look at a tale like Cinderella, for example, it's only from the second edition that you will find that doves peck out the stepsister's eyes as punishment at the end of that tale. So they are intensifying, they're adding that punishment to teach a moral lesson. So it's not as if there's no violence in the tales before the Grimms take their editing to work on the tales, but they're often intensifying
And as I mentioned, the fairy tales were part of a larger body of work that they hoped would foster a German national identity and perhaps help prompt the unification of a German state. I'm so curious how they saw fairy tales as fitting into that.
For quite a long time in the history of the published fairy tale, there was this notion that you had to dress up a fairy tale. You had to dress up an oral telling to make it suitable for publication. It had to be made more literary, more stylized, and the Grimms rejected that view. They thought that the tales were of merit in and of themselves. They thought that they pointed to this vast heritage that they were unearthing through their work, through the tales, the legends. And part of this is that they're living at a time, particularly as young adults, when the German-speaking lands are under the shadow of the French. In fact, Hessen Kassel was occupied by the French, and Jakob was actually librarian to Napoleon's youngest brother. He had been installed by Napoleon as the king of the Kingdom of Westphalia. So they see collecting fairy tales, other texts, as a way out of this French cultural and political domination, a resurrection of this sense of German cultural identity, even though they knew that many of their tales really had French cultural influence, in addition to the influence from other fairy tale traditions. And they thought that their edition was also of scholarly value. They were criticized at times, even when they published their first edition, as having tales in the collection that were not suitable for children. But they were really explicit in saying, well, fairy tales are for everyone, not just children. It's interesting that if you look at some of the monuments that are erected at the end of the 19th century in Germany, we will see some references to Sleeping Beauty, for example, and that as a metaphor of Germany being asleep and now awakening as a political entity. Similarly, the legend of Barbarossa, which the Grimms helped to popularize. He too, the legend that he is asleep and that he will awaken. There is this turn toward depicting scenes from legends and fairy tales that the Grimms helped make popular.
That was Anne Schmiesing speaking with us today about her new book, The Brothers Grimm, A Biography. One of the smallest and poorest countries in Europe is tucked just between Ukraine and Romania, Moldova. Like Ukraine, Moldova is still grappling with a legacy of Russian and Soviet influence. Also like Ukraine, that tension extends to the Orthodox Church. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Ukraine fired 6 long-range missiles today into Russia. The U.S.-made missiles, known as ATACMS, hit a weapons depot in the Bryansk region, according to Russia's defense ministry. Ukraine admitted striking a depot in the region but did not specify what weapons were used. Neither side's claims have been independently verified. The strike comes on the heels of the Biden administration authorizing Kyiv to launch American long-range missiles into Russian territory.
Following the strike, President Vladimir Putin updated Russia's nuclear weapons doctrine. It now permits a potential nuclear response to any strike by an adversary that is supported by a nuclear power. A Kremlin spokesperson confirmed that the Ukrainian attack with U.S.-made ATACMS could now trigger a nuclear response from Russia. Putin has warned the U.S. that the use of longer-range missiles by Ukraine would mean that Russia and NATO are at war. These developments come as the world marks 1,000 days since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine is making some leaders among the Christian clergy in Moldova rethink their alliances with Moscow. Moscow is where the Russian Orthodox Church is based. A growing minority of Orthodox priests in Moldova, along with their congregations, are turning away from religious authorities in Moscow. But as Katie Toth reports from Moldova's capital, Chisinau, this is not a realignment the country's main Orthodox Church will take lying down.
In the quiet suburbs of Chisinau, Father Maxim Malenti's small Orthodox church is currently nestled behind a construction site. rebar sticks out of blocks of concrete beside piles of dirt. And as he looks at this project, it's clear Priest Malenti has a vision. A soup kitchen, a Sunday school, a library, a new shelter for victims of violence. But most of all, a place for the community to come together, the same way they did to support Ukrainians fleeing Russian invasion.
Ми бісерика не мобілізат принтри примі кас акордем з демена діаштор.
The church mobilized the people in the village Sunday at the service. They asked them to help with what they can. And in a few days, they gathered mattresses, food, and clothes, and a lot of donations to this shelter.
This new building, it's also an insurance policy.
Este un centru multifuncțional care va include și o biserică mai mare, fiindcă satul.
There will also be a new, bigger church here, he says, because the village is growing. But he might just need it for another reason, too. See, the Orthodox faith in Moldova is caught up in a battle over territory right now. After Russia invaded Ukraine, churches in Moldova were forced to take sides, to keep aligning themselves with the Russian patriarch who has been blessing the war, or to align themselves with the Romanian patriarch, who was opposed to the invasion. Tired of the Moldovan church's approach to the war in Ukraine, Malenti and his congregation made a choice together: to leave the Moldovan Orthodox metropolis tied to Russia for the smaller Bessarabian Orthodox metropolis, also here in Moldova, that's tied to Romania. After he takes me up the stairs of the Moldovan Theological Academy, Protopope Iulian Race says the Moscow Patriarch's blessings for the war do not reflect the Moldovan Church's beliefs. We pray for peace, he says. When the Russian Patriarch started blessing the war, Race says the Moldovan metropolis told the Patriarch they disagreed. At one point, they even considered joining the Romanian Orthodox Church, but as a whole metropolis, together. But that didn't pan out. What really hurts, Race says, people like Father Malenti are turning away from the church that baptized them, raised them, and made them priests. Which is part of why his church has been suing priests and congregations like Malenti's that leave for the Bessarabian metropolis, saying they can't continue to use religious buildings they don't own.
Biserica nu a fost dată de acasă, de către părinți.
Race says the priest didn't inherit the church building from his parents. It belongs to the organization that built it. So why would he be able to stay there? This is something that's been discussed in Moldova's courts for decades. It's complicated, but Race ties it to churches becoming state property in Soviet times, meaning the debate over who gets to use what is murky. In 2004, a court deemed hundreds of churches the property of the Moldovan metropolis. In 2023, another court overturned that decision, and the debate continues. If the building doesn't belong to Father Race's diocese, does that mean maybe Father Malenti and his congregation can use it? Regardless, Race says this religious fission doesn't make sense theologically, and it prevents his church from being able to enforce discipline, since rogue priests can just leave for the other guy.
Biserica Ortodoxă nu este la fel ca...
The Orthodox Church is not like a grocery store, Race says, where you can just shop the sales. The 17 branches of Eastern Orthodoxy each have their own turf, and they're supposed to respect each other and work separately. Race says the Romanian and Russian Orthodox leaders need to turn to a mediator and work out some kind of lasting deal at the top so that Moldova isn't stuck in this turf war. The Romanian-aligned church group, the Bessarabian metropolis, they see things differently and say it's not a problem to have different churches in the same place.
More than 50% of Moldovan people have Romanian citizenship, and they identify like Romanian. We have Ukrainian churches, we have Russian churches.
That's Father Constantine Olariu with the Bessarabian metropolis.
I don't think only one church to be here. I think every church must take care of his believer, but not one church to control altogether.
His camp is a small one. About 90% of Moldovans are Orthodox Christian, but according to the U.S. Department of State, only about 10% of that group are part of Olariu's metropolis. But he says that they're growing, and that since the war, they've had about 60 congregations leave the Moldovan metropolis overseen by Russia to join this one overseen by Romania. Olariu says they're going to keep accepting any Orthodox communities who want to join. For The World, I'm Katie Toth. Chișinău, Moldova.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast player. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We hope you can join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.